Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome back Scott Guthrie.
Great. Well, thanks everyone for coming back. I hope you had a good lunch. And I hope your head is not completely full after this morning's set of announcements and content. I know there was a lot there. The goal, I think, with this meeting is make it hopefully an interactive Q&A. So I actually don't have any fixed presentation, but I think we have about an hour to open it up to questions and hopefully take this talk in whatever direction you'd like, and hopefully have this as an opportunity to talk about anything you'd like. So any question is fair game. And if no one asks any question, it's going to be a really awkward hour, because we'll just stare at each other and wonder which of us used the Purell. But with that, open it up to questions here and hopefully fire away. Sure, we're just going to make sure, raise your hand and we'll bring the microphone to you. So.
Okay, hi Scott. I enjoyed this morning very much. Thank you for that. I have a question. So how are you going to attract the programmers and the developers that typically are not .NET developers, mm-hmm. are for, developing at Amazon and at other platforms? How are you going to get them over to your platform?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think the thing that we've been kind of really focused on, the last 18 months to 2 years in particular, and so you're seeing a lot of the announcements and, you know, releases even today, is, you know, how do we attract and grow our developer base even more? You know, we've got a very large set of developers that use our technologies today, but I think, you know, especially over the last decade, I'd say, you know, that people would be, I'm either a Microsoft developer or a non-Microsoft developer, and there are two camps. And, you know, how do we blur the lines between those camps and, you know, really have a set of conversations with developers that haven't used any of our stuff and get them into using our stuff? And, you know, they might not use all of our stuff. They might not use all of our platforms. But if you can at least have the conversation and engagement, then you can win or lose on the merits of your individual technology as opposed to, you know, what camp or what religion you believe in terms of from a developer perspective. And, you know, the part I feel enthused about in terms of progress is, you know, if you look at the perception of Microsoft as a company in the last 18 months, like it's changed pretty dramatically, but especially in the developer community. You know, we're number one on Hacker News, which I actually care a lot more about than being number one in a Wall Street Journal article or New York Times article, although if anyone from those two organizations are here, I love them and be happy to do an interview if you do one, want to have an article. But, you know, for me, the litmus test was actually, for today, more than traditional press, was, you know, both was our core base happy, but more importantly, were we reaching a new audience? And, you know, Hacker News has not historically been a Microsoft audience, but it's been fun to see over the last 18 months, both Hacker News, Reddit, Slashdot, you know, the number of articles that are actually sometimes effusively praising Microsoft in those organizations or in those locations probably now outnumbers the ones criticizing. And, you know, if you read the comments around the open sourcing of VS Code that we did today, you know, people that are diehard Linux fans saying, you know, my number one editor on Linux now is using VS Code, and I can't believe Microsoft did that. And, you know, once you have that conversation, then you can have a broader conversation around some of the work we're doing around Visual Studio Team Services. You can have a broader conversation around Azure. You can talk about data and analytics and R and a lot of the work we're doing there. And, and so I feel good right now in terms of how the tone of the conversation has shifted. And, you know, the thing that we try to be within, say, my leadership team is be very data-driven on not just the tone, but is actually the usage. And so one of the things we track pretty closely is what we call deeply engaged developers, which are basically developers that are spending at least an hour 10 times a month using our tools. And that typically indicates sort of a cohort of people that if you're spending 10 separate sessions of at least an hour in length, you're doing something non-trivial, you're not just tire kicking it. You know, how do we track that usage and is it growing steadily, and the nice thing for both Visual Studio you know, Pro and Enterprise, the IDE, but then also Visual Studio Code and Visual Studio Team Services, we're seeing now really significant growth in all three in terms of deeply engaged. And so that is also a way that I'm looking at in terms of measuring not just tone changing, but is that translating into a lot more people using stuff. I do think also as we think about, you know, bridging the communities closer together as well, you know, an important part of it is also recognizing that the world is moving to a more polyglot kind of approach, where in the past you'd use, you know, one thing for everything. And, you know, I think one of the things that we're trying to do, and hopefully you saw today, is making it so that regardless of what language or what OS or, you know, even what server that you're actually building apps against, how do we have Visual Studio and our development technologies be the best place for you to do it? You know, I feel good that we now have the richest Go development support of any tool in the world. We don't even have any Go products ourselves, but with extensibility and with VS Code, you know, that ecosystem can now actually get, you know, use our stuff. And, you know, as a result, you know, they'll use other things. And I think we need to feel comfortable with Microsoft developers or people in the traditional Microsoft camp using different technologies as well. And, you know, when you enable that flexibility, I think developers win. And I think developers end up, you know, hopefully feeling, you know, even more excited about Microsoft when we enable that and when we provide great tools and great cloud and great infrastructure that empowers it. And so, you know, that ultimately is a big part of our strategy. And I think that is going to grow our developer base significantly in the years ahead. And we're going to do a great job making sure all the existing technology that we've shipped gets better and better. And you saw a lot of the .NET improvements that we shipped today, a lot of the core VS improvements that we shipped today, a lot of the Windows app development improvements shipped today. So it's not zero sum. But, you know, I think if we can both make our existing friends happy and make new friends, you know, I think that's great for all developers. I think it's also great for, just given this audience, for any development manager or someone leading a development organization, because it also means you have a much broader set of employees that you can recruit from, or potential employees you can recruit from. You can keep your employees even more engaged, and, you know, I view that as a key part of what we're trying to enable as well with our overall strategy. But it'd be great to get feedback on it, and, you know, I think, you know, we're still need to make a lot more progress, and, you know, the next couple of months will tell in terms of whether, you know, the tone and some of the continued increase in terms of usage continues. But right now, I feel pretty positive. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Yuri Giller. I would like your kind of comments on the latest announcement between Microsoft and Red Hat partnership, and probably what you would comment on Docker support, how, you know, what are current activities and what we should expect in the near future. Thank you.
Yeah, so I mean, the question was around the partnership we announced 2 weeks ago, I guess, with Red Hat. And, you know, specifically, we announced a number of things with Red Hat. One of which was Red Hat is bringing their services and offerings to Azure, so our cloud, and doing it not just in terms of letting Linux VMs run on Azure, Red Hat VMs run on Azure, but really doing a pretty comprehensive enterprise support agreement with us, where, you know, our support teams for Azure and Red Hat are now co-located and will provide unified support of Red Hat solutions on top of Azure. Which is something that they've not done with any other cloud provider out there. And they're also integrating their management tools and other stack with our cloud. And so we're excited from a partnership perspective in terms of enabling that. And again, going back to the how do we enable much more flexibility in terms of all of our products, whether it's the developer space like you heard today, whether it's in operating systems like we did with Red Hat, whether it's some of the partnerships we've done with Oracle and SAP and others around databases, and whether, you know, you look at, say, Office on the iPad or on the Mac, some of the work that we've done there. You know, it's part of a general theme that we're trying to do in terms of integration. You know, I think it's important, you know, whenever you have two vendors that do a partnership, especially two big vendors, you know, the reality is, you know, we're both partners and we also compete. And so, you know, do I want everyone that runs Windows Server today to go out and buy a Red Hat license? You know, no. And likewise, does everyone, every Red Hat customer go out and buy, our Azure Stack offering and ditch the Red Hat OpenStack offering on-prem? I feel confident that Red Hat would say that's probably not their intention either. So, you need to look at this in terms of less around encouraging people to switch and more of a case of just recognizing the fact that most large enterprises have a little bit of both stacks inside their organizations. And to the degree that we can play nicely and integrate our solutions in a nice way, that's good for our customers and enables a win-win for folks. And we're still going to compete very much on the merits of our overlapping technology, but do so in a good, respectful technology way, and then partner on a whole bunch of fronts where it's much more complementary to both of us. And so that's the partnership that we struck with them, and again, I've done similar ones with SAP, with Apple, with IBM, with Oracle, and a whole bunch more. In terms of kind of the improvements we're making, the Windows Server 2016 release that we have coming out next year is probably one of the most significant Windows Server releases we've ever done, and I feel really good about the improvements and the capabilities that are included as part of it. We are building in Docker support directly into the OS, and so containers, both the containers that other operating systems have, which are a case where you have kind of a single VM isolation boundary running multiple containers within it, will support that. And we use some of the Docker APIs in order to expose it. So the Docker files and the same management mechanisms that you use on other platforms work as part of it. We also have something we call Hyper-V containers, which provide even additional layers of isolation so that if you don't want to have kind of a multi-tenant model inside your organization, if you want to be able to isolate or separate critical components, you can do so as well and still maintain the same management APIs. And that's something that other operating systems don't yet support today, and so we think we'll be first along that lines. The other thing that we're making some really great progress on with Windows Server is around a whole bunch of new security and auditing capabilities. We know that's something that's top of mind right now for everyone. And so there's tremendous improvements, just-in-time escalations is built in as a feature so that if you can run so that your dev team can't actually debug an issue except when there is an issue, or debug a production app unless when there is an issue, and you can have a just-in-time escalation model for them to actually have a temporary token in order to work on it. That's a great feature that's being rolled in. And then a whole bunch of improvements to the storage, networking, core management layer, end-to-end throughout the system. So again, we're feeling good about the investments we have with our core server operating system. But it doesn't mean that we won't partner with Red Hat or other server vendors as well. And I think you'll continue to see us kind of innovate on both fronts. Actually, I should mention also on the container front, the other thing that we are building is, we talked, and Scott Hansman used it in one of his demos today, is the Azure Container Service. And the Azure Container Service not only lets you run sort of Docker, but also basically includes orchestration capabilities that layer on top of Docker, things like Mesos, things like Swarm or Marathon, you can even run Kubernetes and others. And it basically allows you to effectively say, hey, I want to spin up 30 VMs and I want to deploy 1,000 containers, or I want to spin up 30,000 VMs and I want to deploy 200 containers, and I want to be able to manage and orchestrate that across the system. That's a service that will go public preview very shortly. It's in private preview right now. We'll support both Windows and Linux-based VM containers. So, it's a very, very flexible system. What's nice about that is we'll ship it first in the public cloud Azure, but we'll also bring it onto on-premises with our Azure Stack offering, which is basically our consistent Azure offering that you can run in your own data centers. And so that container service will be a feature of that. That also comes out in that 2016 wave of Windows Server. And so that gives you, I think, a really nice model that you can use to build pretty much any type of application that uses containers, take advantage of full open source, and then run it in a consistent way, both in public cloud and inside your own private cloud environment. To my knowledge, no one else is doing that but us.
Good afternoon. My name's Kevin Dudley. I have two quick questions. One is around, what are the use cases where you typically see developers using Hyper-V now that it's included in Windows 10, Windows 8, versus Azure for development? And the second part of that question is, does Microsoft have programs where, say, an enterprise could take advantage of, you know, those Azure credits for their MSDN subscribers and really manage their intranet development?
Yeah, good question. You know, it's I think we see, so the first question was around Hyper-V. When should developers use Hyper-V on their own local system versus, you know, say, for example, use virtual machines inside Azure? It's a good question. You know, generally what I've seen is a lot of people using Hyper-V locally for cases where you want to effectively set up and manage a dev environment that you can kind of, you know, install and do a bunch of stuff with, and you can very easily snapshot and restore into a clean state. And so if we're kind of a tight interactive feedback loop, you know, that's a great mechanism to basically take advantage of the local hardware you already have and be able to run it even more efficiently using Hyper-V. And having it built into the Windows 10 makes it even easier to do that. The place where I think the public cloud Azure ends up being super useful for development is probably in the dev test category of, you know, once I have code and I want to simulate it or I want to basically test it out in a multi-node environment, you know, often either it is resource intensive to do, you know, 8 VMs running simultaneously on my local laptop, or you want to have an environment that you know is repeatable and that, you know, that someone locally can't make a change and screw up. And so you want to be able to run it in the cloud so that every one of your developers is using the same environment. And you know that it's different than the dev machine, so that if the dev just happens to have a file or a change that it wasn't checked in and not part of the deployment script, you're not going to get a false positive or a false negative on your tests and then have them break in production. And that's where public cloud, I think, ends up being super useful. We showed in some of the demos today in Brian's talk around the ability to do release management with like a QA, a production integration environment. You know, the beauty about that is you can use now Visual Studio Team Services to manage all of that. And then with Azure, you can actually have those environments and machines stood up and actually have those be your physical resources or virtual resources that, you know, you're doing your various staging environments in. One of the services that we didn't have time to demo today, but is public preview now today, is our Dev Test Lab service. And this is really ideal for anyone that has any dev test environment. I'd recommend checking it out because it basically has a whole bunch of features that allow you at an engineering manager level or as an IT level to basically say, I'm going to give you a dev test environment, dev team A or B, and here's what you're allowed to do in it, and here are the policy controls on what you can do. And so it has built-in support for snapshotting and restoring VMs, but it also has the ability where you can say, look, if the VM isn't being used, turn it off so it doesn't actually waste money. And so you can automatically set policy around, you know, idle machines after 2 hours, turn them off. Or make sure that at 6 a.m. the environment is up, and you know, at 8 p.m. we're gonna automatically turn it off, or any of the policy kind of controls you want to. And that's something that I don't, no other public cloud vendor has built in, and we now support as of today with this new preview. And it does mean that you can also use your MSDN credits. And so you can basically, you know, run things at a super cheap rate as part of it, so it enables you to save even more money. And then if you want to, for each of your MSDN subscriptions, one of the things that we now enable is we give free credits as part of the MSDN subscription. So I think for like the Enterprise Edition, I think we give about $150 a month of MSDN credits or Azure credits. One of the things you can do is you can now, whoever owns your subscription can allocate them out even to Active Directory-based accounts so that your employees are using your standard company credentials in order to actually use their Azure subscriptions. And you can now manage that in a central way. So that is something that's supported. And again, if you have a MSDN subscription today, which I think everyone in this room probably does, that is, you know, free money that effectively you get as part of the subscription that you can run for your dev test environments. And the reason I always kind of say for most companies that are looking to use the cloud, you know, start with dev test, is two reasons. One is it's often the lowest risk environment to start with because it's not production. But two, you know, when you add up the amount of infrastructure spend that a typical IT department spends on dev test environments, in many organizations that we've worked with, it's between 40 and 50% of total servers that they have are actually being used for dev test. And the average CPU utilization of that infrastructure is typically in the 6 to 8% range, which basically means you're spending a heck of a lot of money on hardware that you're not using on-prem. And you know, the beauty about moving that to the cloud and using the new dev test lab environment is, you know, you can dramatically reduce costs out of the system as you do it. Yeah, or?
Yes, sir.
There's one there. And then
Hi, Scott. Hi, Scott.
Whoa.
Hey. HoloLens, obviously a very exciting technology, has a great promise. What's happening there? And when do you see general availability? When do everybody get to get one at home?
Yeah, I mean, HoloLens is pretty cool tech. We are releasing the dev edition, I think in the next couple months. And so I believe you can now order one. I don't think we're shipping them yet, but we've either about to order, you can order them now, or we're about to enable you to order them. Right now we've been working with a bunch of customers in the early preview of it, building solutions, because we end up learning things from it and then using it as a way to harden the system. I do think it's one of those tech scenarios that will revolutionize a whole bunch of businesses over the next 2 to 3 years. So it's not also a 10-year horizon thing. I think this is more of a, you know, applications and practical deployments will certainly happen in the next 2 to 3 years across a lot of enterprises. I'm pretty enthused about all the different scenarios for how you can use it. You know, a couple of the customers I've worked with or seen demos and interacted with, one of them that was pretty mind-blowing, because I actually got to use the app, is one that NASA built. And basically, you know, you go into this room, you put the HoloLens on, and the beauty about HoloLens is it's not virtual reality, and so you don't have the same disorienting feel that you sometimes do when you use a full virtual reality stack. And it has the benefit of being able to integrate your environment in a deep way. And so, you know, this one that NASA built was basically they took all the lunar lander, rover photography that they had, and they basically built a 3D model of Mars. And so you walk in and you actually are on Mars, and you actually see the rocks and the formations, and you can kind of just walk in freeform around the room looking around, and you can even like look under the rock and actually see like what's under the rock and behind the rock. And they've had a lot of NASA engineers actually been using the app. And there's things where people that have been on the Mars program for 10 years and have looked at, you know, lots of 2D images all over, where they're suddenly discovering things that they just couldn't see in 2D. But as you're walking around interactively, you go, wow, what? That rock color is different. Why is that? Or wow, this rock formation, this thing fell, why did it fall? And you know, it's kind of been eye-opening for them in terms of just the ability for them to understand their own domain in a deeper way. I think one of the things also that I'm seeing a common pattern on already with Azure is around how do you use the combination of IoT plus machine learning and Cortana analytics inside Azure to get insights around, you know, any hardware mechanism. So we talked about the Purell hand reader or the hand washer today, but you know, we're working with ThyssenKrupp, which is doing elevators and doing preventative maintenance on elevators. Rockwell Automation, which is automating gas dispensers and fuel equipment. Ford's adding IoT sensor data to all their cars using Azure, and a whole bunch more. And you know, what's cool, especially for anything where you have kind of a services-based model, the ability to take IoT sensors and know that the dispenser is having a problem or the manufacturing line is having a problem, detect it using anomaly detection with machine learning based on the IoT reader, and then have the service technician arrive, put on a HoloLens, and be able to look at every single part in the facility and be able to see the health, the readout, the complete service history dashboard in real time as you're actually staring at that particular device, and be able to see even instructions and training videos in situ on how to actually fix and address it, completely changes the whole technician service repair industry in a pretty profound way. And so I think, you know, you'll see cases like that in particular. That's more of an enterprise use case. HoloLens will be perfect for. And so I'm pretty excited to see all the stuff that's built with it. It's pretty science fiction, but when you can actually touch it, it's science fiction that isn't in a book or movie. It's kind of real, or it is real, I guess.
Sir.
Okay. Oh, thank you, Scott. Being an IT leader, there are things that trying to absorb technologies like you presented today, and trying to figure out how best to apply them to my, you know, mission-critical environment. I have issues that keep me up at night. I'm sure many of these people in this room have similar issues. What I wanted to ask you is, as a leader at Microsoft, what does Microsoft need to do in addition to what you presented? The number one issue, at least in your mind, that keeps you up at night, that you say Microsoft, that you want to drive Microsoft to accomplish in the next 2-3 years?
There's so many. in terms of, so like what from a business perspective keeps me up at night, or? Well, you know, I think the, you know, what's the number one it's both a super exciting time in the tech industry because everything is changing, and there's so many, you know, new things and new scenarios. I mean, but when everything is changing, it's also a little scary, because you basically, you know, from a business perspective, you need to understand, okay, where's the puck moving? How do we get there? And then recognize, hey, we've got a lot of here, there, and so how do we get from here to there in a non-disruptive way, you know, is I think the thing that not just Microsoft, but pretty much every company right now is grappling with. I think there's some article I was just reading, I think on the plane coming over here, which is the average tenure now of a company in the Fortune 500, or the S&P 500, you know, is now under 15 years between entering the S&P 500 and going out of business. That's the average. And those are the biggest 500 companies on the planet, or release in the stock market. And so, you know, the disruption is definitely all over. And I think, you know, all of us as leaders kind of are grappling with that and understanding it. And, you know, it impacts in a bunch of different ways. I'd say one of the things that I spend my time thinking about then is sort of how do you embrace that disruption and, you know, not be afraid of, okay, how do we do change? How do we actually change culturally? How do we change business model-wise? How do we change technology-wise? And, you know, if you lean into disruption and, you know, can figure out where the puck is going and help your customers get there, then, you know, you can not only survive disruption, but you can hopefully thrive in disruption and be even more important and more relevant in the future. And I think that's true for everyone in this room, you know, even as leading the teams that you lead, you know, how do you help them embrace all the new stuff that's coming down all over, not just, you know, events like this, but every thing. And you know, if you can embrace that and build better apps and better systems, you know, you can really help your company thrive. And I think I talked about it in that keynote, and I'm not just trying to be trite, but I really do think software and IT can be much more valuable in the future than it is even today. Because as more things go digital, the number of opportunities for developers and for software to really change even physical processes that software didn't touch. You know, I mentioned you know, the service technician that goes and actually improves equipment that's failing. You know, that traditionally is a much more automated or a manual process where you've got, you know, a book of instructions and someone goes out and it requires kind of human knowledge to do everything. You know, if you can do IoT, if you can actually have a web and mobile-based solution, if you can use something like HoloLens, if you can use machine learning to do anomaly detection before the thing breaks down, you know, you can completely transform your organization. The same is true from a selling perspective. If you could identify better customers, identify who your customers are going to churn, et cetera. And software is needed to do all that. So I'm bullish in terms of disruption, but it does mean that, you know, every day you've got to be on your toes and you do need to kind of not sort of be complacent as you move. And, you know, I think when people say, oh, Microsoft's being bold, you know, with open source today or, you know, other things that we've announced in the last 18 months, it's partly because we're trying to be bold and really embrace that disruption that's happening all around. And, you know, we feel good right now that, you know, from the message we're hearing from customers and so forth, people saying, look, I like that you're being bold. I like that you're actually doing this. And I want you to be more of my vendor than not in the past because you are. But it does take a little bit of courage to do it. You know, hopefully it works out, continues to work out well. I will say also is the number one thing I'd recommend, and we talked and showed some of the demos here today, for anything in tech, people ask me, you know, because we run, you know, millions of servers in our cloud now, you know, what is the one thing I would focus on as an engineering leader also is having good analytics and having the ability to understand what's actually happening throughout, whether it's your business or whether it's your technology stack or your deployed applications. You know, in this world where lots of things are interconnected now and lots of things are evolving quickly, you know, data and analytics is super key. And part of the demos we showed around like App Insights as an example, you know, being able to tell your developers, ideally even before it goes live, hey, the performance is dropping in this check-in versus the previous check-in, or latency or error rates are increasing, or hey, do people on this device have an issue? How can you identify that very quickly, do a fix and deploy it? You know, having the analytics and then having the agility to move quickly, those are probably two things, you know, both technology-wise, but also then just broader business model-wise, that, you know, the two things that I focus on a lot internally as enablers.
My name is Amdi Arnfer Nielsen. I have a question on security in Asia. There's a great, at least perceived, comfort in being able to go to the basement to your firewall and see the LAN cable in one side and the WAN cable in another. If you move your data or your systems to Asia, I know you have some initiatives. Can you reveal what, if you will do extra in the future to ensure that we do not jeopardize our data legally or technically if we move to Asia?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. I mean, a couple of things we do in Azure. We actually are just about to launch our new Azure Security Center in a few weeks. We didn't show it or talk about it today, but we showed about an event we did last month, and I think even yesterday, that Satya did an event in DC. Is one of the things that's great about it is it means any app you deploy in Azure, we can actually proactively tell you, have you secured it correctly? You know, do you have IP addresses that don't have application firewalls? Do you have security keys that you haven't rotated recently? Do you have, you know, weak passwords somewhere? And, you know, basically provides kind of a view that an organization can effectively set policy in terms of what's needed. And you can then immediately see, regardless of whether it's, you know, a VM application, a web application, what database you're using, what technology you're using, you know, here are the 25 things that you should fix before you go live that are potential exploits. And then the other thing about the security center is it does give you readouts and analytics so that if you're being attacked, we'll actually detect it and tell you. So if you have a denial of service attack going on, or if someone's trying to use a brute force password attack against you, you know, we can also proactively notify you of issues and be able to alert. And the nice thing about it is it integrates with existing security systems you have. So if you have Splunk or you have ArcSight or you have something that your security department's already using to monitor your internal infrastructure, we now have feeds that can actually integrate as part of that, which can make it much more secure. And so, you know, we very much view all of those things as part of kind of our enterprise grade promise that we like to provide with Azure, and as a differentiator versus say AWS or Google or others in the market. So those are kind of features that we provide that we think can make people much more secure. In terms of the part that you mentioned in terms of, hey, there's a confidence when you can go to the data center and touch the machine versus if you're running in a virtual cloud environment and you can't. And it's true, I mean, there's definitely a psychological, if I can see the server, if I know Joe and Bob and Fred are the three people touching the server, you know, there's a little bit more comfort because you know it's their three's fault if they screw it up. And whereas if you're running in a virtualized hyperscale cloud environment, you don't know all the people behind it. Yeah, I would say one of the things, though, that as a lot of our customers have evaluated Azure and really looked hard at their on-prem infrastructure, you know, the same thing that gives you comfort where, like, I can go and touch the server, and I know that Bob can go touch the server, is also the thing that should kind of freak you out. Because if a human being can touch the server, and if, you know, Bob can install anything random on the server, you know, there is a loss of control that you do have, because if Bob turns out to be a rogue person or Bob accidentally installs malware on his PC, you know, you can really get into a bad security situation. And, you know, an awful lot of enterprises are now coming to us and saying, you know, we've now concluded because we have such a heterogeneous environment built up over 20 years of systems inside our data centers, we've got massive security problems because people can go into our data centers and touch them, and there are lots of people that can, and there's just a wide variety of manual steps that we sometimes need to take because not everything inside our data center is automated. And one of the beauties of a hyperscale environment is we can't have human beings actually do all that stuff because you just can't manage that when you have millions of servers. And so having everything be automated, having everything be kind of a lights out facility ends up in many ways actually leading to a more secure environment than anything manual. And of course, you can always lock everything down on-prem, you can automate everything on-prem, but most environments and data centers are not in that clean state today. And you know, that's partly why we're seeing even big financial firms starting to actually move to the cloud, is because they've concluded it's easier to actually clean it up and move it into a completely automated cloud environment than it sometimes is to actually go and touch every server they have and clean it in a good environment. You know, I'll give you an example of sort of surprised me when I was going back to being data-driven. We're seeing all these police departments and court systems in the U.S. adopting Azure in the last 6 months and signing, you know, sticking tons and tons of data inside our data centers. And one of the things we couldn't quite figure out is why. And we sort of started double-clicking to try to understand, you know, why do you need 200 petabytes of storage tomorrow? That's a lot. And one of the things that was interesting was in the U.S. there's been this big push around what we call body cameras for police departments, so that anything a police officer does is recorded, and so it can be used. And you know, if the police officer does something bad, it can show evidence of it and take corrective action. Or you know, if someone claims they did something bad, you can also look at the video and see did they really do it, and you can use it from that thing. And so a lot of people are adopting those systems to store any video, and that generates tons of video and tons of data. To store any of that content, you need to put it into a data center that's called CJIS compliant, which is the Criminal Justice System certification. And to be CJIS compliant, every single person in that data center needs to have a full criminal background check and have been certified that there's nothing that you've ever done that's wrong. And part of the reason why we're getting so much of this data now in Azure is we're the only cloud vendor out there that is CJIS compliant. And most on-premise hosting environments are not CJIS compliant because it tends to be fairly expensive when every single employee in the organization has to go through this. And so most people don't bother. And you know, as an example, you know, as a sort of simple example on the compliance front, that's sort of an example where even if you looked inside your organization and said, do you have all the auditing controls? Is every one of your employee criminally background checked? Is every one of your suppliers, are you decoding the firmware and looking for malware or looking for exploits? There's almost no data center out there other than some of the hyperscale cloud vendors that that's probably true. And you know, I think that also will help contribute towards security and making the cloud even more secure. You know, the other thing I'd just say is security is one of these things you're never done. And anytime you say I'm 100% secure, you're kind of deluding yourself because you know, attackers are out there and the threat environment shifts. But you know, we are certainly very committed on our side of doing everything we can to be secure. And you know, I do feel good in terms of from a controls perspective, we have a fairly mature environment and you know, continually looking for how we make it even better and better going forward.
Could you give a little insight maybe into your BI vision or BI story? I mean, today we saw a little bit about R and I saw a slide of Power BI, but it really wasn't mentioned. Could you give a little more insight about, is there a holistic story or anything like that around it?
Yeah, good question. So it's about our BI vision and kind of where we're going and from that perspective. There's a really good talk, I think it's now online, that we did last month at our SQL PaaS conference. And it's sort of specifically our BI vision. And a lot of people have said, it's the best BI talk we've given in at least a decade. And so the 60-minute synopsis of this question, I definitely point you at that video, because I think it does a good job of kind of laying out our overall strategy and where we're going. In general, I would say I feel really good in terms of where we're going on BI. In particular, the releases that we have in motion that will all ship over the next six months or so. Our Power BI service is an example that we just GA'd this summer is seeing pretty massive growth and you know, provides, I think, a fairly disruptive approach to BI in that it enables kind of a self-service BI model with dashboarding. There's mobile apps for iOS, Android, Windows, works with any browser, and it integrates with any backend. So you can go against SQL, you can go against a Teradata system, you can go against an Oracle system, and we allow you to integrate data from everything. So you can go to Visual Studio Team Services and pull all your Scrum and bug tracking and work item tracking data and interject it in your BI dashboards. You could take Google Analytics data and inject it. You can take Marketo data from your marketing campaigns or your Dynamics CRM or Salesforce data from your CRM system and start to compose reports and views that give you a real 360 view of what's going on inside your organization. And then what we've done is really added very powerful visualization capabilities as part of that. And with our Power BI desktop tool, you know, I think people are now saying we're really, from a completeness perspective, versus say a Tableau or Click, you know, now really A, giving them a run for their money and in many ways surpassing it. And then the beauty about Power BI is, you know, we're on average about 1/10 the price. And so we're giving a good value opportunity there as well. More broadly on the back-end side then, I mentioned R today. One of the things that we're really looking to do is how do we enable you to integrate R, to be able to integrate machine learning on top of our core data stack and be able to do that on top of in-memory systems. And so with SQL 2016 in particular, one of the things that we've done is integrated R directly into the SQL 2016 engine so that you can actually run R applications and or R scripts directly on top of the SQL store, including our in-memory table support. And so you can now build machine or data models and do simulations 10x faster than you can pretty much anything else out there. And the beauty is you're able to write them using open source based R as a technology. So anyone coming out of college that has a data science background is immediately productive. You can use Visual Studio, give them those tools. You know, we'll integrate R inside VS Code as well if they want to use other non-Windows platforms. And so, you know, we're going to try to make it super easy to build those types of solutions, run it on any data, but in particular optimize it for our data systems, and then use Power BI as well as SQL reporting services and all the other BI offerings that we have in order to actually visualize it and provide insights. And we did just ship with Power BI our support, so you can also now create visualizations using R and surface it directly inside Power BI. And so you can literally, if you've got a phone, you know, you can secure app data stored either in the cloud or on-prem. And the nice thing about Power BI is it also has an on-prem connector. So you can pull data, integrate it, ship it out on mobile devices, completely secure it, lock it down, and enable a really nice DevOps workflow, or a really nice data workflow inside your organization. And then check out the video. It's the SQL PaaS conference. James Phillips, I think, did it. And it's a really good BI roadmap that hopefully you'll find exciting. So I'm getting the one more question allowed time. So.
So this one should be a quick one, I hope. In terms of Azure, where do you see government and law enforcement? You talked about that briefly, but some of the government cloud capabilities is a bit behind the rapid pace of innovation in the public cloud. So how do you see that gap, you know, in going forward? I mean, can we close that, or how do you see that going?
Yeah, one of the things that we're focused on is, so a couple of things that we're doing, just for the broader people in the audience. We have what's called the U.S. government cloud. That we host here, not surprisingly in the US, that's available for federal, state, and local agencies to take advantage of. And it's basically an isolated instance of Azure, so it's the same feature set, and it's basically operated by a government contractor with top security clearance, so you can put classified workloads in it. So Microsoft does not have access to any of the data inside the cloud. And then we also are setting up all over the world, other clouds or regions that have strict data residency promises, so that you know, similar public sector around the world can go ahead and take advantage of it. For our U.S. government cloud, we don't have 100% of the services yet that we have in our other regions, but we're working very hard to get to 100%. And I think we're going to publish a roadmap quickly of the timeline. It's not a question of if; it's more just time. You know, we're shipping lots and lots of stuff right now everywhere around the world, and there's basically some degree of work we need to do to completely enable the isolation. The isolation's there, but the operation in an isolated way, because we can't debug the service ourselves. We need to have a third party debug it in that government cloud. And so there's some degree of work that we do to basically onboard the service. And then once it's there, the features are kept in sync and up to date. And I think right now, you know, we're missing, I think we probably have about 70% or 80% of our services in the government cloud, but our goal is to get to 100% quickly. So I would say over the next couple of months, you'll see that fully develop. So I'm trying to figure out timing-wise. I think the red dot means I'm out of time. Correct me if I'm wrong, someone else, but there's a super quick 2-minute question. I can do it just because it'll upset everyone backstage, so it'll be fun. So let me.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Scott. First of all, I have to say this morning's keynote session is great, especially at the end of the session. We find out using Microsoft Azure, the root cause of the other Scott Health problem.
It's stress, yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry, I have two questions. They should be quick. First one, regarding Visual Studio. In the morning mentioned it support, say Python, JavaScript, even Pascal is supported. My question is, why Java development is not supported? You know, Java development is a big community. Is this in your roadmap, or what is the reason Java is not supported? Second question is for Azure. There are many exciting technologies on Azure, but if you look at the entire cloud industry, Microsoft is playing catch-up game. So my question is, what do you say to Amazon customers to convince them to switch to Microsoft? Thank you.
Sure. On the Java front, it's not a philosophical reason why we haven't shown Java in our client tools yet. it's mostly recognizing that there are other Java IDEs out there today that are fairly mature, and we want to make sure that rather than sort of litmus check, we have Java syntax coloring, you know, have something that could really be used. And so we focused more on our Java support with Visual Studio team services on the back end. And so we talked about Jenkins, we talked about Maven, we showed release pipelines, build pipelines. We've really tried to focus on how do we enable the back end of the Visual Studio family to work great with Java and work with Eclipse and IntelliJ and existing Java tools. And you know, at some point in the future, we might very well add Java support inside our client IDEs as well, but we want to make sure when we do it that we have a good story as opposed to kind of a minimal story as part of it. And you know, so that's philosophically where we're at, but definitely enabling teams that have both .NET and Java and other open source technologies to be able to use Visual Studio team services on the back end. Absolutely, you can do that today, and we've got lots of large customers already taking advantage of it. On the Azure cloud front, you know, I think most people today would say the cloud race for infrastructure and apps is pretty much a two-horse race between Amazon and us. And you know, so I feel good that people are sort of see us clearly separating, the two of us separating from the pack. We are number two right now in the market. There's sort of this car company, Avis, that used to have this great slogan, we're number two, which means we try harder. And so I like to use that same model in terms of for Azure. And you know, I think the thing that we are really focused on in terms of differentiating is, A, how do we provide more and more higher value services? You know, a lot of the data, or a lot of the developer services we showed today are great examples of where that those higher level services are much more than just VMs and storage and networking that you can take advantage of. We've got similar higher level services with data, with IoT, and a bunch of categories. And I think that's one of the places that we've been seeing a lot of customers both switch and adopt us is because of that. And then I think the place where we do have a different point of view that I think helps is really around the hybrid aspect and having a story where we can say we're hyperscale like Amazon, that we run in more countries and provide more data residency guarantees and more enterprise grade level support than Amazon. But then also on the hybrid front, we give people the flexibility to build applications that can run in our data centers or in your data centers or in a partner data centers. That combination of those three, I think, are things that enterprises and businesses in particular are going to care a lot about. And you know, I think we have a very unique, different point of view there. And that's a big part of the reason why we've seen our growth. And you know, right now, you know, I think most analysts would also say we're growing faster than Amazon. So even though we have a smaller base, we are now growing faster. And you know, I think we're very early in the cloud wars. You know, we've got a lot of roadmap ahead for everyone in the industry. And I think the other thing that's exciting about the cloud is it's not just we're moving existing systems. As you saw with the Purell solution, this is fundamentally new apps that are being built. And so I think the pie is also expanding for everyone. And as long as we have a unique point of view and we can deliver a great service, you know, I feel very good that the roadmap's good for us. It's you know, probably good for the other guy as well. But you know, I think we're you know, together, I think we're going to be innovating quite a bit, and I think it's you know the real winners are going to be all of you and everyone out there that can take advantage of these because I think it's going to be an exciting time for everyone. So I think I'm getting the please get off stage message here, so I might need to go. I want to say again thank you everyone for coming to the event, and look forward to talking more. Thanks.